Yes, we realized that there was a blind spot. Large companies, they also have a lot of cash in their banks, and they haven't really realized that. Is that cash really working for the climate and for the planet, or is it actually driving up emissions? Is your cash and assets used for that? So that was a background for why we created that Green in Cash Action Guide. It can be so for companies actually that if you start to calculate the what we call financed emissions, it could be enormous, and it could be just as high as the other scope 3 emissions for some companies. It's both an enormous risk but opportunity for the companies.
Welcome to New Horizons, the podcast where we explore the behind the scenes of sustainability in the outdoor business. Today, our topic is climate action, and we will discuss how to move toward achieving a net zero operating space by 2050, as outlined by the Exponential Roadmap Initiative. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the so-called IPCC, is the scientific group assembled by the United Nations to conduct research, monitor, and assess all global climate-related science. According to the IPCC, we all must halve emissions by 2030 and continue to do so every decade to achieve global net zero by 2050, to limit temperature rise to as close to 1.5 degrees Celsius as possible. While setting net zero target is the initial step for companies, the real challenge lies in the implementation. This is why I'm very excited to have Johan Falk with us, who, together with Owen Gaffney, co-founded the Exponential Roadmap Initiative, and their mission is to facilitate the halving of global greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and beyond through exponential climate action by companies. So, welcome, Johan. So grateful to be able to speak with you today.
Thank you, and so great to be here. Thanks for that.
Johan, you're on your mission, and I'm stating your mission statement here. It is to unite innovators, transformers, and disruptors to drive the transformation to halve global emissions before 2030 through exponential climate action and solutions. Johan, would you like to introduce yourself? What is your background? And please tell us also what that mission statement actually means and how the initiative came together.
Firstly, I'm the father of 3 kids. So that's, of course, starting point from my perspective. My professional background is in the tech industry. I've been at Intel Corporation, Ericsson, number of startups, and working with business innovation, exponential business development, really scaling up new businesses. And the heart of this tech industry is actually exponential strategies. And around 2017, well, 2 things happened. I was part of founding something called Our Kids Climate. Basically, how we as parents can start to take action for a better future, motivated by our kids. And when I did that, I had to go really deep into climate science to really understand it. I was formulating like a first type of op-ed or something like that, because the idea was to how could we recruit more men to that particular movement? So I got that particular mission. And when I did that, something changed in me, and I took that sort of decision that I need to change direction. So that was my sort of a tipping point, because a lot of people will realize that they might have a tipping point which made them change direction in life. Now, I came in contact with Owen Gaffney. I heard Owen on the radio and said that was a fantastic sort of talk from him in regards to nature. So I need to start to work with him. And we started to think about different ideas. The one was really that we need the type of exponential thinking in terms of address the climate challenge. We can't do it in a linear fashion. And he and me, together with Johan Rockström at that point in time, we came up with this idea that could we apply a similar thinking as the Moore's Law, if you're familiar with that, in the Intel and IT industry, that we basically halved, we doubled the number of transistors every 18 months, which we've been following for 50 years. So that was the sort of basic thought behind the Carbon Law. So it's inspired by the Moore's Law. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that later on, that we need to halve emissions every decade. So that was the first step, the Carbon Law. And after that, we followed with a number of steps, the exponential roadmap, the business playbook, to onboard, as you said, the sort of the best companies in the world, the front runners in terms of climate action, and so on. So that was the starting point of the initiative.
So then let's talk about the Carbon Law. That seems to be a key aspect of your initiative. What is it all about? And can we say that this was sort of the starting point of your discussion with Johan Rockström and Owen Gaffney?
Yeah, that is right. And from a scientific perspective, it was concluded by the scientists that you can actually translate what is required to be able to keep global warming as close to 1.5 as possible. We need to halve emissions by 2030 and every decade after that, while protecting and restoring nature. And the power of the Carbon Law is that it's very simple, it's very straightforward, it can be understood even by a CEO, halving emissions every decade. And we can translate it to, you know, companies, to cities, and even to our own personal life to follow that type of thinking. So it's a really powerful tool, and it's also putting the focus on halving by 2030, which we have as part of our mission, because that is the most important halving. We need to cut out the emissions in the near term, not only focus on the long-term perspective, which was the case, I think, before we started this initiative.
So this is the difference to previous initiatives, and this immediate action focusing on 2030 is unique about the Exponential Roadmap initiative.
Yeah, I think that is one unique thing when we started, but we have worked through Johan Rockström's work and through all of us, basically, to to influence all other initiatives to actually embed the halving by 2030. So that has been a key part of our strategy to actually to scale and spread that narrative, to get others to pick it up. And I think we've been pretty successful. The UN, the Race to Zero initiative, has incorporated halving by 2030, and it's also influenced, I would say, the narrative both in Europe and in US.
Okay, so a strong focus already on the first decade. What is your approach?
From our perspective, of course, the focusing on 2030 is really absolutely essential. It is also about that we need to scale up the solutions to shift out the fossil economy and to scale these solutions exponentially. So the exponential thinking and the theory of change, how to achieve an exponential scaling, both of the solutions that we can talk more about later on, but also about climate action. And that is, of course, the reason why we particularly bring together the frontline actors who are going in the front line with the idea to show that the solutions are implemented today. They are attractive. They are desirable. They are possible to implement. And they are possible to scale. Because in that case, we can inspire a bigger group of actors and companies to take action and to get the spiral going. So that is the theory of change, going the absolute front line to innovate, to drive both the narrative as well as the solutions and climate action. And doing that together, togetherness is absolutely essential. And it's not about competing. We actually manage to convene these companies, which might be competitors, to work together with a common mission. Because it's also important to realize that net zero, you can't achieve that as a company on your own. It's impossible, of course. You have to work with your complete value chain to achieve that. Your suppliers, your customers, you do that together. But even that is not sufficient. You have to work with a complete society to influence society, even outside your value chain, to achieve that. So there, I think, we have a couple of points where we are unique. We are about sharing. We don't want to duplicate anything. We develop everything as open source. We're happy to work with all initiatives and all other initiatives also to pick up or copy what we are doing. That makes us more successful.
Halving emissions by 2030 in every decade after can only be achieved by truly working together. But this needs to be coordinated to inspire action. So let's talk about the Exponential Roadmap Initiative report and the 1.5 degrees Celsius business playbook.
Yes, because the carbon law, after we that was developed, we asked ourselves, well, now what if we're focusing on halving by 2030, do we actually have the solutions? Is it achievable? Is it possible? And that was the reason why we kicked off this first Exponential Roadmap, which we used as the name further on, the Exponential Roadmap. Basically looking at, do we have the solutions to take us to the first halving? Because that is essential, of course, because otherwise it's just a dream, you see. We developed that with the scientists and industry and NGOs up to 2018. So that is a report. Called Exponential Roadmap. So it basically highlights what are the key solutions, 36 key solutions that can take us to the first halving. And the conclusion from that report is that, yes, we do have the solutions in all the sectors, but they have to be scaled in parallel. We can't do it sequentially. It's about the solutions in the energy sector, you know, renewable energy, efficiency, heating, and so on. The industry, of course, it's about buildings, transportation, food and land, and also building up the nature-based solutions. All that has to happen in parallel. The solutions exist to take us to the first halving, some of them even to the second halving. But here is the but, of course. To achieve that, we need to accelerate the solutions. And the acceleration comes from climate leadership, that we get this critical mass of companies, cities, regions that actually start to push in the right direction. But we also need to shift finance to accelerate the solutions. So that's the second pillar. We need the key enabling policies, not the blocking policies, you know, because we have a lot of blockage in the system, which makes scaling really difficult. And the final one is how we can apply exponential technologies, such as ICT, AI, to accelerate the solutions. So the conclusion from that report was, yes, we have the solutions, but we need to really activate these levers. But then when we sort of communicated that report at the Global Climate Action Summit, that was 2018, with Christiana Figueres and Johan Rockström. So it's a quite strong presentation, which you can watch on internet if you like. That narrative has been picked up later on and further amplified by the IPCC 2-3 years later, stating that we do have the solutions. So I think it puts a good stake in the ground, that particular report. And now we have a lot of exponential roadmaps and reports. I think we inspired a good movement there. But then, of course, the next question was, well, how can we support implementation and acceleration? And we concluded that, well, from our perspective, the business community is a prioritized one because the solutions primarily come from the business sector. And there is already strong movement from a number of leading companies going in the front line in terms of climate action. So that was the reason why we decided to develop this business playbook. And why did we need a business playbook? Well, we thought that it's really essential to translate this carbon law, you know, to something which is science aligned, which is simple, which is sharp, sufficiently sharp, so it can be used by companies to implement the strategy which is aligned with the 1.5 ambition. So that was the background for the playbook. And we done that together with scientists, but also NGOs, a number of companies. I think we had 67 people or something over time who has reviewed the playbook. And the playbook is more like a software because it's being updated every year to incorporate the latest standards and the latest best practices. So it's the guiding principle for when we onboard companies as well and how we influence different types of standards and new movements.
So you have identified that the solutions already exist. That's a key message, right?
Yeah, that's a key message.
So this is one part, right, of the business playbook, scaling up climate solutions. But there are three other pillars as well.
Yeah, that's right. And what is really important when we develop this framework, the four-pillar framework, is that the company should take a holistic approach to climate and nature action. So these four pillars, the first pillar is about cutting your own emissions, which could be, you know, your buildings, transportations, energy inside your own operations or your own processes. That is essential, of course, your own backyard, which you have the most control over. The second pillar is about your value chain, which is often, well, it's scope 3 emissions for people who are sort of into accounting, carbon accounting. But to explain what it is about the emissions from your purchased goods, what you put into your product from your suppliers, what we call the upstream, but also the energy they use, the material to get into your own operation, if you're that type of company. But also the downstream, the usage of your products, the energy use, but also the material and the potential waste of that material. So that is the value chain. There is, of course, a very strong focus from leading companies to reinvent their value chain. The third pillar, as you said, is about scaling up solutions, because pillar 1 and 2 is about the down curves, how we cut the emissions. But the third pillar is about the up curve, scaling up solutions, which shift out the old fossil solutions. Example could be, of course, renewable energy, energy efficiency solutions, heat pumps or plant-rich food, etc. In every sector, the solutions we talked about. And here it's really essential for companies to also set targets on scaling up the solutions, just as you have targets for cutting emissions. And finally, the fourth pillar, that is about how we can influence climate action in society. And that is about taking part of collaborating with others in your industry, but also beyond your industry, to be able to influence policies. Because we need these enabling policies to make it possible to scale up the solutions and to cut the emissions. But it could also be to invest in protecting and restore nature, and so on. And the leading companies that we work with, they have strategies spanning over all the four pillars.
Can all pillars be considered as equally important?
But all are essential, but where you can achieve the biggest impact will differ between different companies and different industries. So that's important to keep in mind. I think it's important to state that you can't just work with a fourth pillar, for example, communication, and unless you do your own homework, pillar one and two. If you are we work also extensively with the third pillar, climate solutions, because we need to develop, the methodologies, how we define the climate solutions, how we can set targets, but also to be able to categorize what we called solution companies or climate solution companies, which have basically all their business in these type of solutions. Could be fossil-free steel, that's one example. Plant-based food or heat pumps, as we mentioned, that's one example. Regenerative agriculture. Now, these companies also have to take care of pillar one and two. You can't have the argument that we are making so important solutions like smart electrified cars. We also have to take care of that these cars are produced by, circulated or a fossil-free material, renewable energy, and in an ethical way and so on. So it's also important for these companies to address pillar one and two, even if their primary focus will be on the third pillar. When it comes to the fourth pillar, of course, there is a stronger opportunity for large companies who can have a lot of influence, reach a lot of people, billions of people, to do a more, even larger impact on the fourth pillar.
Thank you, Johan. That was great. So while the primary focus can differ, only engaging in communications is a no-go, which brings me to another question. The companies that are part of the Exponential Roadmap Initiative, they are very powerful and they are representing quite a significant share of the global GDP, which gives them also considerable influence. So on the one hand, it's very beneficial that these companies are informed by backed-up science when making decisions. And if they can reach the climate goals, we have a fair chance, I guess, of achieving them globally. So it's very positive to have them on board. On the other hand, there are many of these businesses that are also under a lot of scrutiny also. So how do you ensure that the Exponential Roadmap Initiative doesn't get hijacked? And how do you maintain your integrity and prevent it from being used for greenwashing?
So that's a great question. So when we onboard companies, they go through a climate performance review. So that means that we assess the companies according to the four pillars in our framework, which is about reducing your own emissions, the scope one and two, reducing your value chain emissions, and having targets and plans in line with the 1.5 ambition, which is about halving emissions by 2030 and a goal to reach net zero by latest 2050, but preferably 2040. But also accelerating solutions and contributing to climate action in society. So we have a baseline, which is based on the Race to Zero criteria and the Exponential Roadmap Initiative's criteria, which the companies have to pass in order to be part of the Exponential Roadmap Initiative. So that's a foundation. We can also work selectively with other type of companies to support them to come up to this level. And we have one or two cases on that. But then they are not officially members. And from our perspective, it's essential that we can remove companies who doesn't fulfill these requirements over time. It's also important for all our members that we keep a high level and a high standard. And also, I would like to add that we are not, as an initiative, dependent on any specific companies.
So that means they go through an onboarding process. And then if they, for example, they tick all boxes, but then along the way something happens, or they are trying to influence, let's say, the way that you judge, for instance, the science-based climate action, how do you deal with that, for example?
The actual criteria, of course, the companies, we review our criteria, and anyone can have input on that. But we are independent from that perspective, so it can't directly be influenced by the companies, the review criteria from our perspective.
So the companies that are presented on your website are going through regular checks with you, and there is accountability.
There is a yearly review with the companies, basically, where we assess them on the criteria. So they need to be to basically fulfill the criteria. Then obviously there could be challenges on how quickly you can reduce emissions. And from our perspective, it's essential to transparently communicate what are the key blockers. We call that the innovation, which could be based on that there are particular blockers that needs to be removed, and the companies need to communicate about these transparently, which we think is absolutely essential. But if the companies over a period of time don't deliver according to our expectations, they would have to leave the initiative. That's correct.
One thing you mentioned is the financial institutions that play a key role in this transition. And there is one instrument as well in place, the Greening Cash Action Guide. What is this? What is it about?
Yes, we realized that there was like a blind spot, if you look at this pillar two or whatever, from the company's perspective. Yeah, there is focus on cutting emissions with your ordinary suppliers, but actually large companies, they also have a lot of cash in their banks, and they haven't really realized that. Is that cash really working for the climate and for the planet, or is it actually driving up emissions? Is your cash and assets used for that? So that was a background for why we created that Greening Cash Action Guide. And it can be so for companies, actually, that if you start to calculate the what we call financed emissions, it could be enormous, and it could be just as high as the other scope 3 emissions for some companies. So it's both an enormous risk but opportunity for the companies. So that is the reason why we decided with some of our partners, Topo and Fair Finance Guide, so on, to develop this particular action guide for how companies can actually start to set up a dialogue with their banks in order to change this, which is a simplified action guide describing these are the key steps, how you actually can influence your bank and take action.
Mm-hmm. And do you have maybe examples of members that applied the action guide and experience they shared with you?
Yes, I can take one example is Iceberg, for example, which is a smaller company, but I would say that their actions seems to have created an impact with their bank. So it doesn't necessarily have to be so that you have to be one of the biggest companies in the world in order to make impact, because you actually ignite that discussion inside the bank by sending that signal as a customer. And that particular bank hadn't heard that before, so that actually triggered them to to start to move in that direction. For example, phase out fossil investments, because what is in the guide is, well, set up, do first an assessment. Well, how much emissions do you basically finance? So that type of data is being developed and is available so that you can actually understand what is your financed footprint through your bank. So that's like the starting point. And the second part is, of course, to set up that dialogue with your bank and to say, well, we expect you not to finance fossil expansion, not deforestation. It's an absolute red flag, but we still have a number of financial institutions doing that, banks doing that. So it's a movement. We have to cut that out. So if we have a number of companies putting that requirement, that will have an impact. And then, of course, the requirement is, well, we need to lower these emissions. So either you ensure to put, which a lot of banks are doing now, putting pressure on your customers, because we know you're using our money to lend out to your customers, to transition their business, or you shift your customer base. So it's like a virtuous loop, basically, where the companies would put positive pressure on their banks, and the banks in turn would put pressure on the companies and so on. So the more we can accelerate that loop, the faster it will go. And then, of course, you could take the decision to shift your assets. That might be difficult for some companies, but if you have several banks, you can shift in between them. But the key point is actually the dialogue, but actually that we work together between the companies then and share the experiences on how you actually can do this in a successful way.
And because you just mentioned Eisbach as a very engaged member of your initiative, do you see a benefit of these smaller companies compared to larger shareholder-oriented global companies?
Yes, definitely. Because, yeah, just take Eisbach as an example. They can really move fast and develop some of these practices and also provide feedback to us regarding all these type of methods and best practices where we're going in the front line. So they are very agile. I do think that I'm convinced, of course, that small companies can make an impact and print in their respective industry by actually inspiring others. That's definitely the case. So they're a brilliant complement to some of the other companies, which maybe reach billions of people. So that cross-connection is very interesting. So with our network as well, that is an opportunity to also maybe influence some of the bigger companies to pick up some of these ideas. Here, of course, we're working with the pioneers, I would say. And the key point is when you reach a certain point, the fear of missing out will be much, much stronger. So what is positive now is that we have both through the reporting, CSRD, well, what would or stressed about that? Well, it might create a lot of administration, yeah, for sure. But it's really a good move because it will take all the companies to the same level. You can't go under the radar, which means that there will be a lot of data so you can really easily understand if this company is what we call future aligned or not future aligned. So let's assume that you have a big company which is in a difficult industry. They haven't started their work. They don't have the targets, the transition plans, the actions in place. That's a tremendous risk. It's just a matter of time before they have to check out or disappear. And I do think it will be important for the finance industry to basically incorporate that in their systems, in the risk assessment of these investments of these companies. So the late entrants and the laggards will, the risk will go up tremendously. It will be a big challenge for companies who haven't started the work, of course. So that is good. But what is just as important is what we talked about, the race to the top, because let's assume now we will reinvent all the value chains completely. So either you're part of that value chain or you will be shifted out. So that's for clear. So in, you know, the companies we work with, if you're not aligned with these requirements as a supplier, you will be shifted out. But it's just a matter of time, maybe not in the short term, but that will happen. And I think when companies realize that you will also get the early and the late entrants, then we will have some laggards, of course, but they will disappear over time. So that competitive force and applying innovation in this race will be incredibly important. And I'm quite optimistic because we are in the early phase of that, but we've seen sort of just that accelerating, in my opinion.
And we definitely need also the policies, as you mentioned, and the legal landscape that needs to give this security in the future framework, right, for these companies to do these investments that are needed.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And we see, of course, certain areas where policy is lagging behind, so it can actually hold back these curves, as we talk about in terms of scaling. We still have very big subsidies of fossil compared, so there is an imbalance where we would need the opposite. So the policies are so important. But it's even more important when you are really early in the curve to actually support the upscaling of new solutions. Like, that would be incentives for, let's take an example, for regenerative agriculture and really make that attractive for farmers to adopt that, both from an economical perspective, so which is important. So it's not perceived that new practices are pushed on forest owners and farmers. It should be made attractive from a societal perspective to actually develop these practices. So these are examples of areas which are really, really super important. Another is, of course, the shift towards circularity, that we still incentivize industry to apply a linear model, which is the waste model. We need to build that into the economical system, as far as I see it, that you have the responsibility to take care of all the materials.
So, yes, you're saying that policy needs to incentivize farming practices to make the shift. What about your members who are not into farming directly? Everyone has a stake in protecting biodiversity, of course, and saving and restoring carbon sinks, for example, in short, to protect nature. So do these companies that are an active part of the initiative, do they all do these things?
The starting point with initiative is the climate, but naturally, of course, climate and nature is two sides of the same coin. We can't save the climate without nature. We can't save nature without climate. So it is absolutely essential. And I would say all of our companies as part of Exponential Roadmap Initiative is in one way or another also addressing nature. We did provide a particular Exponential Roadmap on nature climate solutions together with the Conservation International about 2 years ago, also introducing the carbon law for nature and the need to reach nature positive by 2030. So we are also introducing the nature elements in our framework in a stepwise approach. A key point, as we see it, is not to overcomplicate for companies, so to see how can we basically combine the opportunity to drive action for climate and nature and achieve both objectives. Now, one example could be what we call key performance indicators, which both drive climate action and nature action, such as putting a stop to deforestation, as we recommended as a KPI. It could be to shift towards circular material, shifting away from virgin material, drives both positive development for climate and nature. Could be longevity of the product or durability of the product, which is also really essential KPIs for nature. So that is something we are developing in a stepwise approach, so that if companies develop these, implement these KPIs, they would be able to deliver both on climate and nature. And finally, we are also specifically working on that companies should set science-aligned targets for carbon removals, well, targets and plans, of course, as a complement to reduction targets in their value chain. And carbon removals could, of course, be both restoration of nature as well as other solutions or technical solutions to store carbon.
By technical solutions, you're referring to an engineered solution like machine or filters that capture carbon?
Yeah, what we see is that carbon removals, which could be different type of solutions, where nature is, of course, essential, we can't wait to scale them for another 10 or 15 years. We need to start to scale them from today, these solutions. And that is the reason why we are also working and will drive that companies should also set targets and have plans for carbon removals. But it could be a mix between different type of techniques and solutions.
When you refer to nature positive, what does that actually mean?
So there are some different definitions, but to simplify it, it means that we take nature from being a source to being a sink to start to basically store carbon at the latest 2030. That we also turn around the biodiversity loss from negative to positive. In addition to that, there is an opportunity for companies beyond their value chain to contribute to scaling up carbon removals, which could be through nature, but also to invest in protection of nature outside their own value chain as well, which we do recommend.
So, I mean, you mentioned that the electrification, let's discuss it maybe, taking this as a concrete example here, because also the electrification, it doesn't come without environmental costs, right? So we can have also rebound effects here. So how can your initiative facilitate companies to look at these factors then as well and to incorporate them in their solutions?
For electrification, we need batteries, we need fossil-free steel and so. So as part of our framework, of course, there is a requirement on these companies providing batteries to take care of the complete value chain, all the way from the mining, and to drive towards net zero, but also to limit any damage on nature and also taking justness into consideration when developing their value chains in a new direction. So this requires a lot of work, which has to happen in parallel. So I think we are contributing to that by really putting requirements on these climate solutions companies to also ensure that having a clean supply chain all the way, because we need a lot of, as you said, a lot of new materials, minerals, etc. for the electrification.
Globally, emissions are still rising. Companies need to be more and more ambitious to reach the targets. Can you tell us a bit about your members?
the key point, as far as I see it, is that what we state is that companies need to do their utmost, and that is difficult to measure, of course, to achieve these targets in line with science. So many of our members have these really sharp targets to cut like 50% by 2030 through the complete value chain. That is pretty tough. Some even go further, like Apple stating 75%. And to be clear on that, not by using any offsets. It's actually reducing the emissions in the complete value chain. And we need that type of bold targets. At the same time, we need to appreciate that we need a movement in the complete value chain. And it's also dependent on that we get the move in terms of policies and other type of action in certain places. So we think the key is really to be open, transparent, or saying we have the targets, but there could be certain areas where we don't know precisely how to achieve that. And that could be described through what we call like an innovation or scaling gap. Be really transparent on that. That is what we recommend to the companies, to say that here we need to take more common action in order to break these boundaries together. We need to scale nature-based solutions as well. That would be, of course, stop deforestation. It's about protection and restoring forests, wetlands, grasslands, but also to shift towards better managed forestry, close to nature forestry and regenerative agriculture and so on. So that needs to be scaled. So that's pretty clear. And we really encourage companies to invest in these solutions beyond their value chain as a complement, as several of our companies are doing, but not consider it offsets. It's never, instead of cutting your own scope 3 emissions, it is a complement. But we do appreciate that we need to work with more incentives for companies to actually make these investments. So that is a really important discussion. But the solution is not to do less on the scope 3 and instead invest in these solutions. We have to do both, basically.
Yeah, I think that is really important to highlight. It's a complement. You know what I mean? The Exponential Roadmap Initiative was founded in 2017, 2018, as you explained. And there's an interview with you online. I think it was from 2021. So 3 years ago, where you said, okay, we will see an incredible pace and development. Where do we stand today in the year 2024? Do you feel this movement? How far have we come?
Absolutely. We see an incredible pace in development of solutions, if I start with that. Solutions. There has been things that wasn't on the map a couple of years ago. For example, we will have fossil-free steel very soon. So it's possible. And we have the demand from car manufacturers who will shift to low fossil steel, as far as I see it. We have this tremendous movement in terms of shift to renewable energy and electricity. Let's assume we have 10 million factories or something in the world. We see that the leading factories, they can cut out 50, maybe 60% of their emissions rapidly. And that's been driven by leading companies like Apple, IKEA are two examples, who are very successful to, together with their factory supplier companies, to radically cut out emissions really fast. So that these are two examples of things that are happening. But we see an enormous innovation in all these sectors I talked about, and also movements in terms of much stronger funding I think a couple of examples could be the battery factories, Northvolt, which has been investing in Sweden, but now also in Germany, massive investments. So enabling much bigger amounts of capital. And I think also the finance sector, we see a lot of movements in terms of shifting towards what we call transition funding. So the finance factor realize that they are funding a lot of companies which are not moving sufficiently fast. And now they're sort of shifting towards transition funding. Yes, we can add on, you know. But I would say, of course, we haven't bent the curve yet, which we can see we're still not not following the carbon law, still haven't reached the tipping point. My best guess is we are close to that particular tipping point, and it's more important than ever to keep this pressure up, because a lot of these actions are growing exponentially. So we need to just increase the pressure, as far as I see it, which makes it possible to come into a new trajectory. Because it's all about getting a new direction of the economy, and to get a new compass direction of the economy. And we haven't really reached that point yet. So it's so important to hang in there and just increase the pressure. And of course, what's happened after that? Well, we have certain backlashes as well, which is quite natural, that when we come in close to that particular point, the resistance is getting much stronger, for example, from the fossil industry. So we need to be able to handle that.
Mm-hmm. You just highlight, we have to increase the pressure. Who needs to put the pressure on whom?
Yeah. First, I think we need to realize that to shift out the fossil solutions, we need to scale up the climate solutions. Because if we just try to cut the emissions without scaling up the solutions, you don't have any substitute, and it's not possible. It's not attractive, because we would just lower everyone's standard and access to services. So it's really connected to scaling up. See what I mean? I worked with mobile phones previously, and the idea there was that we don't need any mobile phones because we have the fixed phones. What should you use it for? But when you reach a certain point, we shifted out all the fixed phones. That's quite natural for us. And it's the same with these new type of solutions. So there is a resistance, but we need to come to a certain point, as I talked about, the tipping points, and we need to pass these tipping points in order to get the critical mass, really, to understand that we're moving in a new direction. So it's really about the critical mass. So we have to work on all the fronts, of course. We are very much in favor of going in the front line, showing it is achievable. We talk about the race to the top and the exponential race to the top, that we need now to come to a point where companies and regions and cities, finance and countries start to compete a bit with each other on where you are on that S-curve, because we will shift out the complete economy in all the sectors. And if you are behind on that S-curve, you risk to lose the complete economy. So the race to the top will be incredibly important in that narrative, as a complement to just cutting emissions and sharing the burdens. And we do think now we have the foundation, as Johan Rockström say, from Paris, from Glasgow, from Dubai. We have like a general platform to work from, a commitment that we should go towards net zero. But to achieve that, we need to align the complete economy with this mission and make it more of this race to the top.
So you just mentioned policies, but also, do you sometimes also see companies hindering that change as well? Do you see that as well?
Yes, of course. And that is related to our fourth pillar, you know, that we have in the playbook, that as a company, you need to align your influencing, policy influencing, and your memberships in business associations with this 1.5 ambition. Because traditionally, and today, we see that a lot of trade organizations might work against the transformation, trying to block the transformation. Maybe that could be of historical reasons. You don't want to see any regulation for the existing companies. But remember that, of course, if you have a big position in a particular industry, you might want to protect that by not having any newcomers. And the future companies might not be around the table when it comes to policy influencing. So that is the reason why we're also working on that together with partners to also provide action and action guides in on how companies should align their memberships in associations and influencing. We have to do a lot of work there. And to really strengthen the voice of the frontline companies saying that, well, we need these stronger policies to enable the transformation and not block it. So that is a key point. We think we can mobilize the companies much, much, much more in this policy influencing. And I think one example was for the latest COP, where there was a strong movement from companies in regards to the fossil phase-out, which also shows that it is possible to influence the political process.
Johan, the innovation, growth and competition, but will definitely play a key role, if I'm not mistaken, what you just said, right?
Yes. We talk about the reinvention of the value chains. So it's such an... I think we just tapped the surface. So if you think about it, for example, the energy transformation is quite on its way, but there's a lot of innovation to be untapped there as well. You know, renewable energy, new type of technologies to shift out fossil, but also storage and so on. But there is a lot of innovation happening now in what we call the material transformation, basically shifting out the old fossil-based materials. Because to cut emissions radically, you have to transform the energy system, but also all the material and going circular. There I see tremendous innovation happening and investments. A third area we can mention is, of course, how can we apply digitalization and AI, artificial intelligence, in order to scale up these solutions much faster, but also to be able to scale up climate action. As is AI, a really key point is now that with all the investments in AI, it's really, from humanity's perspective, it's really important to think about what we should apply that innovation for. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is it to further drive up, you know, the emissions through unsustainable consumption? Or is it to actually to use that technology in order to scale up the climate solutions?
So how can we then use AI in a constructive manner that supports this transition towards net zero?
One key point is, of course, if you look at the consumption perspective, that we have an enormous power. Every time we buy something, we vote for the future we want to have. That's basically how it works. So we vote with our wallet. It's also true that people, when in a number of reports or research, has shown that people want to take much more sustainable decisions, you know, for the planet. But we still tend to take decisions in the opposite way. Why is that? Well, I think one part of this is, of course, the advertising, and basically that the whole machinery in terms of marketing is directing us in that direction and really influencing, you know, how we are incentivized and how our brain is incentivized. So it's sort of built into the system. But think about if we can actually get the support in our decisions to take much better decisions that we really want to take in terms of sustainability. That is so important as far as I see it. And the companies have an opportunity, of course, in how they communicate and what type of lifestyles they actually promote in their communication. And AI, so that's just one example where you can apply AI in a much, much better way. But I would say for every solution we talked about, AI can be applied to shift the course to the left, as far as I see it. But also to understand, you know, where all the companies are, and take that example with the factories. How can we scale up these 10 million factories to cut emissions by 50%? AI can be applied for that, to make that analysis, the proposals, bring the funding together and so on. So it's very much unexplored. So we need to sort of put the technology in these directions, as far as I see it.
We have spoken a lot about what companies need to do for the transition. What about us personally and our lifestyles? Do we need to change behaviors drastically in order to align with the net zero targets? What's your take on that?
Of course, lifestyles is so essential. But I do believe that the mission should be that people, we can live a richer, a better life, basically with much, much less resource. Yes, we talk about lifestyle solutions as something positive, basically that there is an opportunity, as far as we see it, to live within the planetary boundaries, but even have a richer life. So it doesn't have to be connected by more difficult life, or where you have to make a lot of compromises, as far as we see it, because today our consumption is very much connected to buying as many things as possible in a wasteful way. We see that with clothing, with things, and also, let's take an example, the private ownership of cars, that our cars are normally parked 95% of the time. So we are so convinced that we can have new models, which is provides a better life, better and a richer life with much, much less footprint. And when we looked at some examples, we see that for we, the 10%, will represent maybe 50% of the emissions. So it's going back to the carbon law again. We 10%, which we are part of. If we haven't done anything, we can easily cut out 50% if we just start to take some conscious decisions without making any compromises, which is a tremendous opportunity as far as we see it. Now, it's difficult to make that, you know, second and third cutting, because we might not have all these solutions in place in society yet. But by actually taking the first steps of this first halving, that will send a strong signal. That will also accelerate the demand for these solutions. But the companies have an important role here to provide solutions which are easy to adapt, but also to promote these solutions, and also to communicate about better and richer lifestyles.
And as this is also a podcast for the outdoor industry, do you have a particular perspective on the outdoor industry that is bringing a lot of people out in nature and for this close to nature lifestyle as a solution provider, maybe?
I think that is the brilliant example, as far as I see it, because to reconnect with nature is just a fantastic thing. And I think as humanity, we have to some extent divorced nature, and that is our biggest mistake. So we need to reconnect with nature again. So the outdoor industry has a tremendous role there. And as we can see from some of our companies, we have like example Houdini, Icebag, they're not primarily focusing on selling as many products as possible, but actually to communicating the opportunity with the outdoor lifestyle as a way to sort of enrich your life. And then it becomes product. It becomes important that the products that you're using, well, treat them with care, give them a second life. And it's not just how you produce them, but actually appreciate what you use, what you buy. So they're also building that into the messages, which I think is one example of that, of actually promoting, you know, richer lifestyles and the connection to nature. So I think the outdoor industry, yes, have a tremendous opportunity to actually show the way there. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much, Johan. That gives us all definitely good motivation. Yeah, so we talked about the consumers, we talked about the policy landscape. There were a lot of questions, a lot of topics and aspects we've covered. Is there something you want to add that we have maybe missed out yet in our conversation?
Thanks for that. I think we covered a lot. I would say that we are sort of, it's important to state, we are in a very critical point in time, I would say. We see a lot of resistance, and we see a risk for hacking the curve and also the political landscape and so on. I think it's more important than ever to work together, you know, and to take action, whatever we can do as part of initiatives like we are doing in our work, but also in civil society, in our work, wherever we are, in order to mobilize this energy that we need to take us over the tipping point towards a better future, we need to mobilize that energy between us. And the key to do that is to work together and take action. So that, I think, is maybe the most important thing. That we need to be persistent. We need to be able to handle resistance. Maybe we can use that as a motivator to taking even more action. And we decided to stay optimistic and positive that we can do it. And in order to achieve that, we also need to believe that we can do it, as far as I see it.
Thanks so much for the closing words, for your optimism. And
yeah, thank you.
All the best, Johan, for your initiative and as a key milestone, halving emissions by 2030.
That's right. Thank you very much for having me. Thanks.
Thank you, Johan.
As we wrap up today's discussion on the Exponential Roadmap Initiative, let's reinforce the critical actions needed to address climate change. The four pillars of the 1.5 degrees Celsius business playbook: reduce your own emissions, reduce also your value chain emissions, provide and scale solutions, and accelerate climate action in society, which also entails investments into climate projects and advocacy. And what is a key takeaway? This must be pursued simultaneously and exponentially. Our pathway to a sustainable future depends on it. Members of the Exponential Roadmap are the trailblazers, providing essential solutions to drive this movement forward. Maintaining the integrity of the initiative is crucial, ensuring it remains independent and unbiased, not beholden to any single company. While nature-based solutions are vital, we can't afford to delay the development and deployment of engineered carbon capture solutions. The time to act is now. Waiting another 10 to 15 years is not an option. We are in a true race to the top. Those who move swiftly will be rewarded, while businesses that fail to adapt will find themselves increasingly untenable. Policy must evolve to support, not hinder, this transition. We need to shift away from fossil fuels and embrace hypergrowth in sustainable solutions. Degrowth in this context means cutting out harmful practices and investing in better alternatives. Our lifestyles must transform not through mere reduction, but through adopting richer, more fulfilling solutions like the shared economy. Additionally, the Green Your Cash Action Guide emphasizes the importance of taking responsibility for the money we have in the bank. Where we choose to invest our money can drive significant change. For companies lagging behind, the risks are mounting. The cost of inaction will only increase. It's imperative for all stakeholders to act decisively and collaboratively. Thank you for joining us today. Let us continue to push the boundaries, innovate, and lead the way to a sustainable future. Until next time, stay committed to the cause and remember that every action counts.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.